Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Razor Law, and this is Lauren Razor. I'm a New York attorney. New York attorney, that means I will not give advice outside of New York law. Most lawyers they know that they cannot give you advice. I can't give folks advice in North Carolina if I'm not barred or not admitted to practicing law in North Carolina. Oftentimes, lawyers from New York do what they call pro hoc vici. We have all these nice little words that we say in the law, and that allows us to team up with another lawyer out of state in order to practice if we want to practice in North Carolina. So you would have to petition the court, team up with a lawyer in North Carolina that would basically vouch for you, and through a court order, then you could possibly practice law in the other state. So I'm a New York lawyer, and I took the New York bar. I did not want to take after the bar that I took in New York. I did not want to go anywhere else because the ordeal was incredible, fascinating, and just grueling. Just in terms of, passing the bar, we had to sit with at the Jacob Javits Center, and there was thousands of people from all over who were coming in to take the New York State Bar exam. I remember riding the train and almost freaking out when the train stopped as usual, but I think I was probably 2 hours ahead of time in terms of taking the exam. It's an experience that tests. You don't know what's going to come. You can predict some of the things that are going to be on the New York bar, for example, domestic relations, which is divorce law and matrimonial law. That's a big one in New York. Probably you'll get something on criminal law. That's also, big in New York. You may get a contract area, something about civil procedure, but you don't really know what is going to be on the New York bar and what they're going to test you on, and which means that you have to study more than 50 or so areas of law and know it hands down because you don't know what, in fact, they're going to ask you. So that was a grueling experience. It's obviously you'd have to get your college degree first. And after you get your college degree, you apply for law school. I attended law school at night, and I attended college at night. But definitely law school at night. I did it in 4 years instead of the daytime program of 3 years. And I chose to work during the day and go to school at night. And yes, it had an impact on your personal life. You study a lot because when do you get to study? You study on the weekends. And you have family life on the weekends at the same time. So it was a difficult, difficult scenario. But, I was a child of the 60s, and pretty much, I had it in me to help people and to do good things for people. And certainly becoming a lawyer was one of the ways that I was going to do that. And I think over my years of practice, particularly in private practice, I've had the opportunity to assist and help so many people with their problems and with the issues that face themselves, their families, their friends. And I have been an advocate for those individuals. It's difficult to advocate for yourself in this court system. You really, really need, especially when you're going up against the system. I've advocated for women. We're a judge. I remember this case, and it was a difficult case. A judge awarded a spouse, a husband, custody of the child. Because the woman, because of domestic violence, the woman had to move into a shelter. This judge, who happened to be an African-American male, for whatever reason, thought that because she didn't have a place to live, that she should not have custody. They did not inspect the father's house. They didn't inspect, you know, where the child, it was a girl child, where the child would be living. And I thought those, it wasn't a case that I was successful after I was given the case. There was so much bad blood. The judge was certainly against the female client. You know, I am not looking to put female and male clients over male and male clients over females. You know, I just want to see a certain level of fairness. You know, people say when I advocate, and I'm not advocating for the sun and the moon and the earth, I'm advocating for fairness. In that particular case, I just felt that when you look at a system like this, it certainly wasn't a fair system. Some people would say to me, and I'll get into the other topic this evening, back to bankruptcy and getting your financial house in order. People would say, well, you know, you're against the man and you want the woman to have the child. No, that wasn't the situation. The father's house had never been evaluated as a place for this young girl child to live. One, that's the first thing. Where was this child going to live? She had brothers. It was a one-bedroom apartment. The child was actually sleeping on the couch or some other type of bed. Never really examined the living conditions of this young lady. And our courts just cavalierly just throw the child, you know, without any investigation into this person's home, you know. So, you know, those are the things that I would be looking at. If those evaluations were made and that the child's living conditions were better than under the mother's living conditions, I don't have a problem with that. But none of that was done. And so, you know, I take issue with that, and we raised our voices and, you know, filed papers and motions. And, you know, we did as much as we could, you know, but we didn't prevail on that on that issue. And that those are the types of things that sadden me in many ways, because I see the system oftentimes depends on, and family court is very emotional. With family court, the judges seem to be more one-sided, or, you know, not like the Supreme Court judges that try to call it the way they see it. Family court judges, I mean, I've had family court female judges not like a female plaintiff. I mean, don't let her say anything, or just hate the men. You know, what kind of, I mean, this is the kind of system that we're up against when you're in family court. It is very, very emotional for these, they call magistrates if they're dealing with child support, and they're regular judges if they're dealing with custody. You know, but the judges there appear to be, particularly the magistrates, you know, like they have an attitude. I just don't know where their training comes from. They're angry already, you know, when the litigants walk in, they take a position against one or the other because of personal issues, not, you know, pretty much calling it the way they see it, you know, but it's like this attitude they'll take against one or the other party. And you know, so I don't see a level of fairness sometimes. And that's really, you know, what I'm always amazed at, that there's constant battle. You certainly need people that are strong enough, and I've had my weary days, everybody knows, are strong enough to continue to advocate. You know, so you're advocating in a system that a lawyer who advocates strongly, you know, may not you know, they may want to sanction the lawyer. You know, they may want to get rid of the lawyer because the lawyer is such a great advocate for their clients, you know, or they may want to sabotage that lawyer. Certainly, those are the things that have happened. But the topic this evening, we said three parts, was bankruptcy and financialness. That's not a word, but I just made it up, financialness. We have to really, really get our financial house in order, and so many of us don't have it in order. We have to really take real inventory of ourselves and lives, and just understand that we're responsible for our own financial wellness, and we have to make decisions, you know, as to where do we want to be. I'm now at that nice age of semi-retired or so, as they would say. You know, where do I want to be, you know, and what, how much do I need? And I told my nephew, you have to start backwards. My nephew's in his 20s, and you have to say to yourself, what do you want to earn and have in the bank when you turn 62? Well, if that's a half million, or if it's a million, or it's a 2 million, whatever it is, then you have to think about now at his age, what do you have to put away? What do you have to put in an annuity? What do you have to put in investments in order to make that happen? The one thing I've learned about my clients, and my clients cross all racial lines, absolutely. They cross all racial lines, sex, gay, lesbians, gay men and women. I've had all levels and all types of clients that have been very good to me. So, you know, I say this because, like, for example, I have couples that buy homes, you know, and I say, you know, your life has changed forever. And why is that? Because back in the day when you bought a home, you used to take lunch bags to work or thermoses to work, and you would be, your home was your greatest asset. People are living in homes now as if they're living in an apartment. A home is a mortgage. You don't pay your mortgage, you can lose your home. Obviously, in an apartment, you don't pay your rent, you can be thrown out, of course. But you can lose your entire investment if you don't pay your mortgage. Your home is an investment. That's very important to understand. But most people just cavalierly not understand that their home is top priority, making your home better so the value of it is better in the future. So if you want to sell it, you put a nice deck in the back or a porch in the front, or if you can afford to build a pool, those are the things you want to do to increase the value of the home. What happens is by the time people get to work, they've spent over $30 just coming into work. And God forbid if they're driving, I can't even imagine what that price is. So what do I mean? Depending on your habits, and 30 days in a month, or let's say 20 working days, you're talking about $600 in sanity or habits, and then you're talking about $6,000 or $7,200 a year, and in 10 years, that's $72,000. That is in lottery tickets. Got to have the lottery tickets, $10 worth of whatever people buy. Then, of course, you have to have your breakfast. Everybody eats, you know, whatever in the morning, and coffee, whether it's Starbucks, $5 right there for a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And then you have, you know, your lunch, your cigarettes if you smoke, whatever the other habits that you have. But then you also have, you know, the snacks during the day. So we're talking about spending a lucrative amount of money per day. You can't do that. And it's hard for Americans to get that through their heads, because our forefathers and our grandmothers and grandparents, you know, they, like I said, you don't see bag lunches almost ever. And, you know, we have a lifestyle that we want to have, but we also want to have this lovely home. The purpose of a home is for you to go home, stay at home, entertain at home. You got a big entertainment room, but you're constantly taking lavish trips that you can't afford. So then don't buy a home. You see, and I say this because I handle loan modifications. So what is my expertise? Why do you think I'm doing this and I'm saying this? Because let's see the kinds of financial issues that I deal with. I deal with people who lack estate planning, okay, lack estate planning. That means they don't have wills, they don't have life insurance, they don't have any investments, nothing. Lack of estate planning, that is puts an entire family in disarray. That's one. Number two, what you do have is I've handled loan modifications. Those of individuals who can't pay their mortgage for whatever reason, down on their luck, or whatever it is that their issues are, they can't pay their mortgage, they're out of a job. So what do? I handle loan modification. That means I write to the bank or get to the bank on their behalf, have my clients take out a HAMP application, fill it out, say why they can't pay their mortgage. We actually hand in that application on their behalf. The banks may reinstate their mortgage at a lower interest rate or may not. That's number two in terms of financial issues. And, of course, we're talking about bankruptcies. In my career, I have done thousands of Chapter 7, not 13, but Chapter 7. Chapter 7 means you want to discharge your debt. That means you don't have to pay. If you get discharged in a Chapter 7, you do not have to pay your credit card debt. So this is what typically happens in a Chapter 7. You know, I have clients that want to keep, you know, I had a client that wanted to keep a car. You know, I have a financial background. I've had it when I was in Long Island University. I also taught finance. So, you know, I really go after individuals that don't make sense because I know it's a matter of your future. So I had one gentleman, I think I told this story. He was in the file bankruptcy and he wanted me to help him to keep his car. You can keep your home in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Make sure you pay your mortgage on time and you're not behind. You can keep your car in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Make sure you keep your payments going, you know, and that, you know, you can afford to keep the payments going for whatever reason. You can keep your car. The thing is, what I try to tell people in terms of that person that I was talking about with the car, well, he had a $600 a month car or vehicle note he was paying. He lived in Harlem, which it was crazy. He lived in Harlem. He didn't work. I'm sorry. Not only did he live in Harlem, he worked in Harlem, and he garaged his car. About $300 a month, and then I asked him about how much gas you use, you know, what is the insurance on the car. So we're talking about $1,200 a month. You're talking about in a car, which could go towards a mortgage. He did not own anything, go towards a mortgage. And he was really, really, his fiance was just doing everything she could to bite her lip, because she wanted me to convince him to get rid of his car. Well, I told him, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. It's $1,200 a month you're paying. This is ridiculous. You live where you have subway transportation. You have all of that. To get a car of that level and to then have to garage it, it absolutely makes no sense. And you're here before me filing bankruptcy because you can't pay off your credit cards or anything like that. So you need to reboot yourself, understand, and put yourself on somewhat of a budget, and I'd say try, and be realistic about your life. Sometimes, you know, we're not realistic about our lives. Sometimes we have to be realistic. We can't afford all of that. We can't afford this. We want our children to have every single thing, and we're so afraid to tell them that, you know what, we can't afford that. With my salary, I can't, our family cannot afford that, and we don't want to say those things. you're eventually going to say those things, because if you continue to live above your means, it's going to catch up with you. And you're going to eventually say you can't afford it. There's a bankruptcy code, Chapter 7, that says you can't afford it. That's why you're filing bankruptcy. So what happens in – what's a Chapter 7? A Chapter 7 is normally where you look to discharge your debt. You'd have to tell them there's an application, or I have a questionnaire I usually ask. Of course I'm going to ask you, do you own property? And it's like that guy, I think his wife went to jail and the husband went to jail because they lied on a bankruptcy application or bankruptcy document that they filed. It's pretty serious when you're dealing with bankruptcy. It's a federal law, which means that's federal jurisdiction. It means that you have to, you know, it says under penalties of perjury, they're not playing around. If you have property, you have to put property, your property down. If you have a car, you have a bank account, you have IRAs, you have retirement accounts. Some accounts, I've had clients that have large retirement accounts. If their retirement account that is subject to an exemption under Chapter 7, then you get to keep your retirement account. IRAs may be subject to collection within the bankruptcy court. It really depends. Most of the time, the bankruptcy judges or magistrates do not touch pensions. Generally not, they don't make you liquidate an IRA. They don't make you do that. But, you know, you have to put your cards on the table, hands up, and you can't transfer property at the last minute. You have a $1 million home and you don't want the bankruptcy magistrate to, to the bankruptcy trustee, bankruptcy trustee to know about it. So you think you can transfer it over to your cousin and put it in your cousin's name. You can't do that within a year to filing bankruptcy. It's important that you know that if you're planning on filing bankruptcy, it has to be a plan. And I say that because, you know, you can't charge up, $20,000 worth of credit card debt or $25,000 worth of credit card debt, and then within a month or two file bankruptcy. That's going to be a red flag for the trustee, that you calculated that you're going to buy all this stuff and then file for bankruptcy. So you also have to be careful. I remember I used to go to my clients' houses, and I decided that was never going to happen again. You know, in the beginning of my career, I went to a client's house, and you know, when I went into her house, you know, I saw that she had like stacks of credit cards. You know, like she was playing cards with them. You know, so then okay, that was the first thing I was looking at, and then she had a big TV in her living room, you know, in a box, and you know, I had to indicate to her, you know, if you buy these things and the bankruptcy court believes that you're buying things with credit cards and sending them to other countries, and then, you know, after you maxed out the cards, then you file bankruptcy, you know, you may be talking about fraud or triggering an investigation. You know, I had a client who, of course, I'm not ever mentioning names, but you can't ship furniture to another country after charge it on your card and then, you know, file for bankruptcy. You know, the other part of it, I remember I had a client I had to tell, you know, I had to be very savvy because, you know, she showed me her credit card. I said, I need to see your statement to get the address for the creditor. And it's called creditor. and the debtor is called the debtor, and the trustee is the person that you would go before that would determine whether you get discharged from your debt. But I remember she had owed, at the time that I saw her credit card statement, I would say it was $8,000. Just say, argument's sake, it was $8,000 or $10,000. So then I said, well, let me see the one before that. And it raises a red flag when your credit card a month before your statement was zero, and then you're 1 month later, you charged up $10,000, and then you want to file bankruptcy. You know, I have to tell the client, you know, you can't pull this. You better wait and don't file now, because it raises a red flag for fraud, that you're getting these credit cards to buy all this stuff. And then and the things that you're buying are luxury items. They're jewelry or TVs and, you know, and TVs and things like that. Well, we'll pick it up next week. Those are the do's and don'ts of filing bankruptcy under a Chapter 7. Chapter 13 means that you're looking to pay it back over a period of time. Have a safe week. Have a great week. And get your financial house in order. It is time.